This episode of Crosscut Talks is supported by Alaska Airlines.
Hello, and welcome to Crosscut Talks. I'm Mark Baumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. So, the future has been on my mind lately, which honestly isn't always the case. Journalists aren't supposed to be too concerned with the future. Those fixated on what could be generally have an idea of what should be and commit some energy to shaping that unknowable then. Your average reporter, on the other hand, is supposed to be more concerned with what is knowable, what did happen, what is true. That's the idea, anyway. Of course, we all have opinions about where humanity is headed, but mostly we just hope that whatever happens, there'll be journalists there to record it. That's no guarantee, of course. The furloughs and pink slips that have accompanied the coronavirus outbreak have provided a sobering punctuation to decades of newsroom layoffs. Even those of us who have been spared can't help but look to the years ahead, now filled with more uncertainty than ever before in our lifetimes, and wonder what's in store. I've also been thinking about the future lately because I've become curious about how it looks right now to the people who are trying to shape it. Is this current crisis, with thousands dying every day, the trajectory of the virus unknowable, a frozen economy slowly thawing, perhaps too quickly? Is this an impediment or an opportunity to their imagined futures? If the latter, how do they expect to navigate the unknowable months ahead? For this episode of Crosscut Talks, I spoke with two women who are in the business of shaping the future. Later on in the show, I'll be speaking with Leah Greenberg, the co-founder and co-executive director of Indivisible, a nationwide network of volunteer-led organizations bent on unseating President Donald Trump and pushing for progressive policies. On the morning of our interview, the organization had announced its endorsement of Joe Biden. The pledge of support comes amid uncertainties for the campaign. We talked about those, including the sexual assault allegation against the vice president, and consider what the party and the country could look like after November. But first, I'm checking in with Katie Wilson, a longtime activist and regular contributor to Crosscut Opinion, who has just started writing a regular column about the impacts of the recession on the city of Seattle. For how long? Who knows? Okay, on with the show. We've got Katie Wilson here right now. She is a columnist for Crosscut. So what is this moment that we're in right now?
I mean, obviously, there's a lot that is hard to predict, right? We have this coronavirus pandemic that has triggered the recession. It's kind of an unusual, to say the least, way for a recession to begin, where we have these kind of enforced shutdowns of large sectors of the economy. And so, I mean, on one level, just who knows, right? We don't know what's going to happen. And not having a clear path to really fully reopening the economy, not knowing whether we're going to have new waves of, you know, the virus that would prompt further shutdowns. There's a lot that's really hard to predict. I think what I see going forward is that we're probably in for quite a prolonged recession, if not a depression. Regardless of the unusual circumstances that started this recession off, in terms of its impact on state and local budgets, we're seeing on a bigger scale kind of what happened in the wake of the 2007-2008 financial crisis, where just public budgets are taking a huge hit because the sources of revenue that they rely on tend to be very volatile, very dependent on kind of moment-to-moment economic activity. So sales tax is a huge one here in Washington State, where we have, as listeners probably know, the most regressive tax system in the entire country. And that is very related to the fact that we don't have any taxes based on income, which makes us very, very dependent on the sales tax and also on a business and occupations tax, which is more stable but still somewhat volatile.
The state Supreme Court announced that it would decline to review Seattle's income tax case, essentially killing the potential of there being an income tax in Seattle, right? And that this came just a day after Inslee announced a big number of cuts. How do we get to a place where our tax base is more stable?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And, you know, first of all, the Supreme Court's decision not to review Seattle's income tax case, while it did nullify the law that Seattle passed in 2017. It doesn't entirely remove Seattle's power to pass an income tax. It just greatly restricts it. So Seattle actually could pass.
See, this is why I need you. See, I go and make assumptions.
Seattle actually could pass a flat income tax of up to 1%. And of course, that would raise like a lot of revenue, probably in the several hundreds of millions of dollars at least. But that's not progressive, right? I mean, we don't want to be making someone who is bringing in only, say, $20,000 a year. We don't want to be taxing them at 1%, right? And so I think there are some challenges to Seattle's using that authority. There may be ways that the city could get creative and, for example, have some kind of grant or rebate type program where it would basically be writing checks to people up to a certain percentage of area median income, for example, to kind of make that into a more progressive tax. But it's going to take some time to figure that out. I would hope that our state legislature would get its act together and pass its own statewide progressive income tax. I think that the state Supreme Court probably would be more likely to want to take a state income tax case under review rather than just a Seattle one. So I think that's a way forward, although definitely politically maybe challenging, to say the least. And then there are a number of other more progressive tax options that both state and local that I think we need to be moving forward on. So a capital gains tax has been under conversation for some years, I think definitely needs to move forward. And locally in Seattle, we have ongoing conversations about some kind of payroll-based tax on large businesses.
And then you just wrote this piece about the city's budget forecast. So the city is saying that it's going to take a hit of between $210 and $300 million this year, which is a sixth of anticipated revenue for them.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And you're saying that maybe that's the rosiest.
Well,
picture,
I mean, that's for right? this year, you know. I mean, yes. So that's for this year. And I think the bigger question is just moving forward into 2021 and beyond, right? The question of how long this lasts. Cutting a sixth of the Seattle budget, I mean, that's not easy. Half of the budget is actually of the general fund is police and firefighters. You know, you don't really want to cut our firefighting force too much. I mean, across the board, when you actually come down to making cuts, it's really hard. And what you're also doing when you make cuts is laying people off. The city's going to have some really difficult decisions to make this year. But then the question is moving forward, if they're having to make cuts next year and the year after and the year after, that's really bad. So I really think that what needs to happen now is elected officials and advocates need to kind of take a stand and say, we are not going down the road of austerity. As much as possible, we are going to try to preserve vital programs and services, including looking at ways to raise new progressive revenue. We can't let the hardships that, you know, Seattle households and small businesses are feeling right now be amplified by the city walking back on the kind of support that it normally provides.
I wonder, how do you prepare to think about, to write about, to approach a very new economic reality when we're going from a period of sustained growth, even though it has been softening lately, to this radical shift? How do you prepare yourself to take on this new reality?
I mean, I guess the simple answer is just like read, read, read. I think that we can learn a lot from history. Over the course of the last hundreds of years of capitalism, there have been many downturns. So I think just going back and trying to understand how our now incredibly integrated global economy has emerged over the past few hundred years is part of the answer. But I also think that what that history tells us too is that there are limits to what we can predict. So kind of the history of economic thinking and policy over that time has been one of professional economists continually being surprised by new things that happened that their models did not predict, right? That happened in the Great Depression, that happened in the 1970s with, you know, stagflation. And so the profession of economics has undergone multiple revolutions. You know, economics is deeply embedded in history, right? And so as history has unfolded and the economy has grown and become this kind of global system, the rules change, right? And so the rules that govern markets in one period are not necessarily going to govern markets in another. So that's just kind of a occupational hazard, I guess, for economists, where it's very easy to get kind of lost in your elegant mathematical models and think that you're doing something very precise, but then, you know, reality kind of intrudes and suddenly you have to pick up the pieces. And that happened big time in the wake of the 2007-2008 financial crisis, which took the profession of economics almost totally unawares. There were a handful of economists who kind of saw the warning signs and the housing bubble and such, but most of them just thought, nope, markets are efficient and rational and it's all going to be fine.
Is it a problem where we're in the same problem with wars, is that we're always fighting the last recession, that we can only apply the tools that have been taught to us through history when we're in what is a totally different situation? I mean, an economy that is systematically shut down and then going to reopen. I mean, has there ever been anything like that before?
Yeah, I think that is a similar problem. And I know, you know, people have been comparing this pandemic to the, you know, the Spanish flu. And but I mean, obviously, we're in a very different world now, right? So it's very hard to look back and find a situation that prepares us for what's going on now. And then with economics, you have kind of the added layer of kind of ideological distortion, where a lot of the point of the profession is to guide action, right? Both of businesses, of banks and other financial institutions, of governments. And so it's also very deeply entwined in politics and the self-interest of these institutions that are kind of using advice from economists and that definitely want to hear some things and not others. So in addition to just kind of the difficulties that are inherent in the subject matter, you also have this overlay of bias and people wanting to hear certain things and not others.
So tell us, what's your underlying philosophy, ideology, bias when it comes to talking about the economy? I mean, what is the lens that you look at it through?
That's a good question. I guess my general perspective is, I mean, we all know that our global capitalist economic system is unsustainable, right? In many ways. Ecologically, we're heading for this climate Armageddon, right? That we have to be slicing emissions by 8% every year for the next decade in order to keep it under the target. And also, we're just kind of running up against the limits of growth, right? We have an economic system that depends on steady growth. And as you know, more and more of the world is kind of brought into this system, like there's just not that many other places that it can expand to. And then we have this kind of skyrocketing inequality of income and wealth. And so there's just so many things about the way that our economic system works that just cannot continue. And I really think that the recession or depression that we're heading into now, I am of the opinion that, you know, although it's been triggered by this coronavirus pandemic, I do think that there were these deep structural kind of imbalances, fragility in the global economy that was going to come out, you know, eventually in one way or another. And so I think that we are entering into a period where there's both the opportunity and kind of the inevitability of pretty deep systemic structural change. And I think there's a lot of questions about how that will happen and, you know, the things that policymakers and advocates and activists do will have a huge impact in kind of the suffering that's involved in those adjustments. But I just, yeah, I guess my general outlook is change is necessary and it's going to happen and we better try to guide it as best we can.
Are you more frightened about what the future holds or are you more hopeful about what the future holds in the long term?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely don't want to minimize the suffering and hardship that people are going through right now as a result of this crisis and that in many cases will continue. But I would say that my overall outlook is one of hope. And I mean, that's partly just based on the fact that like people were already suffering, right? You know, before this coronavirus crisis. And so yes, things are worse, but you know, going back to look at the history of income taxes in Washington state takes us back to the Great Depression in the 1930s. And what happened at that point was, you know, a decade of immense suffering and unemployment and hunger and all these things. But it was also a decade of massive organizing from the ground up, right? Where the industrial union movement that won so many of the programs and things that people are depending on today, right? Like unemployment insurance to get through hard times, right? Those were won by the movements of the 1930s that happened because people en masse realized that they needed to stick together and organize in order to win things. And so I do think that's the nature of the opportunity now, where it's not like, I mean, you don't want to celebrate going into a period of hardship, but historically it's just the case that periods like this do make people more amenable to taking action.
Katie, thanks so much for coming on Crosscut Talks.
Thank you.
And now for a message from our sponsor, Alaska Airlines. Alaska flies to over 115 destinations worldwide, with an average of 1,200 daily flights across the United States, Mexico, Canada, and Costa Rica. Every Alaska flight has high-speed Wi-Fi, free chat, free movies, a rotating seasonal menu, and the highest-rated customer experience of any North American airline. Alaska also tops the charts in environmental sustainability, having been ranked the most fuel-efficient U.S. airline for 7 years running. It's the highest-rated U.S. airline on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, and it helps passengers offset the carbon impact of every trip they take. Learn more and book your next trip at alaskaair.com. Welcome back to Crosscut Talks. We're here now with Leah Greenberg. Leah is the co-founder and co-executive director of the Indivisible Project, which is a grassroots network of activists that emerged after the election of Donald Trump. She's also a former congressional staffer and has spent some time in the trenches of electoral politics. She's the author of the book We Are Indivisible, A Blueprint for Democracy After Trump. And she has appeared on a lot of lists, including Time's 100 Most Influential People of 2019. Leah, thanks for coming on Crosscut Talks.
So great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Leah, tell me, what is your day-to-day right now? I mean, how many hours a week does a movement activist work during this period?
Right now, all of them pretty much. You know, we've got a lot going on between COVID rapid response, between everything that is happening in Washington right now with the COVID legislative response, and getting ready for the general election. So my days are spent pivoting between all of those topics, and then also all of the nuts and bolts of being an ED of an organization, right? The internal management, the communications, the meetings, et cetera.
This morning, Indivisibles put their full weight behind the Joe Biden candidacy for president, right?
That's right.
Are you nervous the night before that goes out, or does it feel like it's old hat at this point, and you're not worried about the negative emails and Twitter mentions?
I'll always be nervous before any big announcement, and I know that you will always get a negative email no matter what you do. But in this case, 95% of Indivisibles voted to endorse Joe Biden. They recognize that the primary is over. Whether he was their candidate or not, he's the nominee, and they are all in for the general. So I felt a lot of confidence that we were reflecting the enthusiasm of the network to get to work and beat Donald Trump.
So everybody learned what Indivisibles was during the 2018 midterms. And you were credited, the organization was credited a lot with the blue wave that we saw. Democrats took 40 seats in the House and took a majority in the House. I'm wondering if the lessons that you learned from 2018 ended up being as applicable to 2020 as you thought they would at the time. A lot has happened since then. What lessons are you bringing into the general election, and what have you had to discard?
Well, one of the reasons I love the metaphor of the blue wave is that a wave doesn't start, you know, the week before the election or the month before the election. Actual waves at sea build and travel for thousands of miles before they actually look like a wave and before they come crashing down on shore. And fundamentally, Indivisible's model and Indivisible's structure is really about supporting ongoing, sustained, locally driven, volunteer-led grassroots community activism. We support thousands of indivisible groups all over the country. They are in off years, they are doing advocacy to drive local priorities, state campaigns, federal campaigns. In election years, they are knocking doors, endorsing candidates, raising money, running for office themselves. It's a virtuous cycle of electoral work fueling advocacy and advocacy fueling electoral work. What we saw in 2018 was a vindication of that model, that we were actually, you know, by doing our advocacy work in 2017, we were building the narratives that would actually dominate the 2018 election. And then we were ultimately replacing the people who hadn't listened to those advocacy pushes in 2017. And I think we're taking the same approach heading into 2020. One of the dominant stories of the last year has been Republicans' total unwillingness to hold Donald Trump accountable, first through the Senate, through the impeachment trial, and now through this huge mess around COVID and coronavirus. We're going to see that be a huge theme of the election, and it'll reflect not just in whether Donald Trump gets reelected, but down ballot. Looking at senators who've been enabling Donald Trump, looking at House of Representatives officials who've been enabling Donald Trump. Those are the kinds of people that we're going to be able to target through the activism and the advocacy that we've been doing and the organizing we've been doing for the last year and a half.
I'm curious if you think that impeachment is really something that people are going to want to hear about in the general election as they are going through this very immediate kind of existential and difficult time. You know, is the general election a time where people are going to want to hear about what happened, like something that happened before this this current moment?
Well, I think that goes back to this question about what are the national narratives and national frames you're pushing. And I'm not saying that we're going to run ads on impeachment specifically, but what we are going to talk about is there's been a consistent pattern for the last 4 years of the Trump administration where he puts his interests above the interests of the country and the country suffers. And that was true in impeachment. That was the fundamental issue that was true in impeachment. And a lot of Republicans during that moment voted to acquit him so that he could continue being president, recognizing that there was this clear pattern. And then promptly, we hit a crisis that's causing thousands of people to die because, again, the administration is incapable of dealing with it, and Donald Trump is putting his personal interests above the country. So I think the thing that's important for us is to make a really clear case that Donald Trump's incompetence, his malevolence, his corruption, it's hurting you directly. It's hurting you as a voter and your family. And there are a whole bunch of people who have been letting that happen because it's more important to them to get tax cuts for the rich than it is to actually stand up for you. And so it's not just about getting Donald Trump out. It's about getting all those people who've enabled his reign of terror for the last 4 years out.
When you're thinking about how to approach issues like this, whether they're the coronavirus outbreak or, you know, impeachment, how much do you rely on polling?
You know, we are obviously always going to be looking at polling because fundamentally polling is part of how you understand if the messages and the frames that you're pushing are working. But also polling is a reflection of what is already being put out into the atmosphere. Great leaders and great leadership are really about shaping the atmosphere rather than seeing what is being reflected back at you. And I think impeachment is a great example of this. For a year after Democrats took the House, there was a lot of fear that impeachment was not popular. Impeachment, you know, wasn't polling over 40%, et cetera, et cetera. Once Democrats actually took a stand, once they made a clear case to the American people that this was merited, that this was a grave offense, that this was important, that polling switched overnight. And that's not because Americans had super complex, really detailed opinions on exactly what constitutes bribery in Ukraine and election interference. It's because we actually made a really strong case to the American people that this was important. And they didn't have to grasp the details. They actually responded to the leadership. So again, I think polls are important. You do want to know what messages are working. You want to know what's hitting. As you get into the election cycle, you should be looking at polling, but we shouldn't confuse looking at polls and actually creating the political conditions that polls respond to.
The leaders that came to power during this 2018 wave span the spectrum of kind of the Democratic Party, which you celebrate. I mean, it really is the product of a kind of decentralized network. Is that you're not, it's not top down, right?
You don't exactly.
You're not serving up litmus tests. So that group of leaders who really came to the table at different times and with different levels of enthusiasm.
It's important when you're elected to deliver for your base. It's important to show people that actually elections have consequences, that the difference between a Republican House and a Democratic House is actual accountability. if people don't see results for the work that they're doing, then they stop doing the work. The actual reality was that the president actually dramatically subverted the interests of the United States for his own political interests, attempted to interfere in an election, et cetera. There are long-term serious consequences to that kind of behavior just continuing unchecked and unaddressed by the political system. We spent 4 months having the focus be on Donald Trump's corruption and incompetence instead of having the focus be on any of the messages that Donald Trump would have preferred to drive as the clock ticks down to his reelection. And that's important. If you think about when presidents really consolidate, how they spend the time during the period before the other party has a nomination or a nominee, they spend that attacking the other party. They spend that defining the frames and the narrative that's going to carry them into the general election. They spend it driving down the other party's positives. Donald Trump wasn't able to do that. He spent, you know, a crucial period of time before his reelection campaign was really launching, just focused on himself and on the defense. And that's actually a really big deal, regardless of whether the actual issue of impeachment is winning over independents. It's totally possible that he might have been able to come up with a frame and a push that would have won them over during that time, and he did not have the chance.
Okay, well, let's move on to the actual candidates, shall we? For a while there, you wouldn't have even guessed that there was a primary going on. I mean, the virus became so all-consuming, but it feels like the last few weeks it kind of has emerged, and now we're having this conversation again. But I wonder if you feel like it's possible for him to reach the voters that he needs to reach with the current setup and kind of the way that he's approaching this sort of isolated campaigning.
Look, I think a lot of things are going to be hard about campaigning in the era of COVID. And one of them is that the vice president is respecting the appropriate health and safety guidelines, unlike Donald Trump, who's clearly actively hoping that he can go back to having massive mega rallies sometime soon. That is a challenge. It's going to mean building out a strong digital operation. It's going to mean working with partners and working to really spread his message in as many ways as possible. It's going to mean, you know, really being creative about how he's engaging people during this time. I think that will all be super important for the campaign to focus on. But I do think that, you know, fundamentally, we've been in a period of time when Donald Trump has really been dominating the airwaves, and Donald Trump's approval has been going down steadily every day that he gets on TV and gives another half-baked, harebrained press conference. I think they ended the primary and really went into a period of active building. We, as a progressive organization, Joe Biden was not among the favorite candidates during the primary. His team has been actively reaching out, seeking to figure out what they can do to engage. And I think what we can all say about Joe Biden is, you know, he listens and he's direct when he doesn't agree with folks. And when he does, he changes his mind. And so what we're seeing is that the campaign is really trying to reach out actively to progressive organizations, trying to build the kinds of ties and connections that they'll need across a winning coalition in order to excite a lot of voters for November. And, you know, on our side, Indivisible voted to endorse Joe Biden. Indivisible members voted to endorse Joe Biden. We had pledged as part of our launch of our primary program that we were going to rally around and endorse the ultimate winner of the Democratic nomination. And we actually asked every Democratic candidate to take the same pledge at the beginning of last year. We were really, really happy that almost every major candidate did ultimately take that pledge. We're really excited to be honoring it right now. So speaking from our base of grassroots activists, what we're seeing is people, Joe Biden may not have been their first choice, but they are ready to rally around him and they're ready to do the work to get him elected.
There have been a couple of different storylines that have, you know, been dominating the conversation around Biden for the last couple of weeks. You know, one of them is the accusation of sexual assault from former Senate aide Tara Reid. You know, recognizing that it's more than a political issue, how do you think Biden has handled the accusation?
Well, we were really happy to see that he addressed the accusation directly and transparently during his appearance on Morning Joe last week and with his Medium statement last week. We think it's really important that he continue to do so, that he continue to be transparent about the circumstances of the situation, and that he engage without in any way attacking or disparaging Tara Reid. We believe very much that it's important that any accusation or allegation of this gravity have a serious reporting of the facts and a serious understanding for the public. And we are glad that he is actively doing the work to make that happen. And we also think that it's important that it be part of a broader systemic grappling not just for Biden, but for all of us, with the dominance and the legacy of sexual violence and misogyny in our culture. These are not individual problems. These are systemic problems. And it's absolutely important that any conversation about this be ultimately able to trace that link back.
And do you suspect that this is going to be a big part of the general election, no matter what?
Well, I think what we knew heading into the general election was that Donald Trump was going to throw everything he has at Democrats. And his classic approach is a culture war attack on all fronts. And so that's everything from racism to sexism to anti-immigrant fervor. We were fully expecting that this was going to be the kind of election where Donald Trump, with no argument for progress, with no argument for most people about how he's made their lives better, is going to run on fear and hatred and resentment. And, you know, that's what we're expecting will be going in now.
So the other major storyline is about the vice presidential pick. So he's said that he plans to choose a woman. And now media and pundits and even Biden himself have kind of cobbled together a short list. Elizabeth Warren, Stacey Abrams, Amy Klobuchar, Susan Rice. There are a few of the big names. There are a number of other ones. You know, it's been suggested that Biden is essentially selecting the next leader of the Democratic Party. Is that how you see it?
It's certainly possible. Vice presidents have a big advantage if they are ultimately seeking the presidential nomination at some point in the future, as we saw during this primary. So we certainly would expect that the person that he selects should be somebody who could be the standard bearer for the Democratic Party going forward. This is really important in terms of what it signals to the Democratic coalition, right? Is Biden attempting to broaden his coalition to form a winning coalition by bringing in folks within the party who might not have gravitated towards him during the primary? Is he looking to, you know, bold progressive leaders like Senator Warren? Is he looking for a diverse ticket? Is he thinking about the kinds of factors that ultimately are going to create, you know, a ticket that is really a ticket that represents a winning coalition? That said, it's not just the vice presidency. It's also about his appointments. It's also about everything from, you know, his transition committee, transition team to the people who are going to be doing, you know, who are going to be coming into his administration and in the cabinet positions. And so I do think it's important to think about not just one individual person, but the whole, whether Biden is committed to building a cabinet that reflects a diverse and progressive coalition.
You said that Joe Biden was maybe not their first choice for the presidential pick. Who is leading the VP list for for the indivisible groups?
It's a great question. We haven't polled our folks specifically on VPs, but certainly the names that I've heard with the most excitement anecdotally are Warren and Abrams. I can say that Warren was pretty consistently the top polling our presidential candidate when we were polling our list during the primary. So that attracts and doesn't surprise me.
Do you feel like you're seeing signals that this could happen, that Warren could be the VP?
I think we are seeing signals. I think that a lot of times when you're seeing these collaborations between politicians, it's a test, right? It's a trial balloon. And so I think that's a great sign. I think that we want, ultimately, this is, you know, a pick that is going to be guided by a relatively small number of people who are going through the vetting process, who are making the selection, and ultimately it'll be Vice President Biden's decision. You can have all the bet makers you want, but most of them are not part of those conversations, right? But I do think that, you know, what we're seeing is really positive signs across the board in terms of the vice president actively engaging and working with a number of women who would be really strong leaders, and particularly Senator Warren most recently with that op-ed, which was great.
If Biden were to select a more moderate VP, I mean, if you've got both a president and a VP that were not among the top choices for your folks, is there does there start to form an enthusiasm gap?
Look, I think our folks are incredibly dedicated to getting Donald Trump out of office. They would crawl over glass to beat Donald Trump. They will be out there, you know, if they can't knock doors, depending on how COVID is shaking out, they'll be making calls. They'll be doing all the work that they can to make sure that the Democratic ticket wins in the fall. That said, I think this is a really important signaling opportunity for Biden to the broader Democratic coalition, because that doesn't necessarily hold for everyone. There are a lot of young people who are still looking for a reason to believe in government, a reason to believe that government is actually responsive to the needs that they're facing. And you really want to choose a candidate who has actually got a really deep reputation and credibility and seems to be coming to the table with solutions that are responsive to their problems. And so I think that the pick is important for what it signals in terms of whether Biden is listening to the kinds of candidates and the kinds of people who have been able to excite youth so far, who've been able to build multiracial coalitions, who've been able to, you know, broaden his appeal beyond everybody, beyond the folks that he won in the primary.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Leah. Thanks for being on Crosscut Talks.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Rusty Bacall and produced by Jake Newman. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Baumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.